Gwenna, how you doing?
What?
Welcome to the podcast.
Welcome to the completely unnecessary Super Show podcast.
Super Show.
It's a Monday. You might hear this on a Tuesday, but it's a Monday, March 11th.
Rare Monday.
2024. We are in daylight savings time. The only time, as far as I'm concerned, that's Ian Ferguson. I'm Pat Contry.
The only time for you.
On the show today, you know, my standard time hatred. Mm-hmm. Every year I talk about it. On the show today, we'll be talking about Warner Brothers being silly again.
Silly, huh?
Zack Snyder being sillier.
That's the word.
WADA signature Heritage Auction sealed game report.
Sealed!
We'll also be talking about a little clickbaity, six things you should know before collecting retro games. Ian did not put down number one there, but he's going to put down number one.
I mean, you took all the other ones I have. That's the problem here. You took very obvious ones.
I took 2, 4, and 6.
Yeah, I'm just saying. I don't know if it's that much.
Well, Ian, you have to think of a number one.
Okay.
We're doing okay out there. Ian, you played the Jeff Minter Gold Masterworks from
Digital Eclipse. Yeah, I played a lot of it. It's another release from Digital Eclipse. If you liked the Karateka release or the Atari 50th, you know the quality level to expect here. It's a kind of a full recap of Jeff Minter's portfolio, basically. Sure. He's kind of been around. One of the interesting things about him is he's been around making games for almost the entirety of what we consider video games. I mean, he's been there since almost the beginning. He started making games in the late 70s, and he's still releasing games today. And I think that's where one of the differences is. A lot of the folks who were important in the early days of video games and video game design, you know, they went on to do different things. He's kind of stuck around in the realm. Very interesting person, very, very interesting games. Definitely always kind of a little on the outside of you know, I mean, they're all, most of them feature llamas or camels with names like
alpacas.
I believe there's alpacas, but like with names like Metagalactic Llamas Battle at the Edge of Time, which is a great game. I really enjoyed that one. You know what you're getting in terms of quality and presentation, and the subject matter is fascinating. The first night I sat down to play it, I sat there for 5 hours going through the various timelines. So, yeah, I would definitely pick that one up.
I added number one for you, by the way.
Thank you.
You can approve. I can't believe you couldn't think of a third one. But anyway, interesting in the preservation/emulation world. This is from Gaming Alexandria. One of the things I know zero bit about, but I did not know this was not preserved, the Epoch cassette game system. I know nothing about this. This was not a domestic console. That's partially why I know nothing about this. Any thoughts? I don't know if I've come across any of these games, even at a convention.
No, I haven't, and I don't think you will. That's probably why, you know, it has taken forever for this to be emulated. It's an interesting system in that and this is probably why you don't see them and why it took forever. Everything you need is in the cartridge. There is, I believe, the base of the system simply acts as an AV pass-through.
That's kind of weird.
Yeah.
Wild stuff.
Yes.
It means the cost of the system should be really cheap.
Here you go. To put it into better language that they used. The base unit has no CPU, none, has no CPU at all. It merely serves as an AV output. The game cartridges themselves hold all the necessary hardware to run the game with a custom LSI that incorporates the CPU, RAM, and the ROM code. This design was similar to the PC-50X family of systems, which were sold primarily in Europe and Asia in the 1970s. So
what an inefficient way to make game cartridges. You're replicating the system hardware in every cartridge? That's bizarre.
Well, I mean, this was 1981.
Consoles are out.
Sure, they are. I'm just saying it's not exactly at the point in time where I would be like, well, you have to know better.
Sure, but there was no precedence for doing it like this. Like, they just, I guess, they decided we're going to try it and see how it goes. Let's see. According to this article, the system was 13,500 yen. Let's see.
And there was the junior that
junior shift for that
days like, after was, the Nintendo Famicom for a five, very five. Cheap 5,000 yen.
So what did the games cost? I want to know. The games couldn't have cost that much more. I guess you, for the you're getting the controllers. So the controllers is what the cost is really. You're saying it's like an AV like throughput with buttons on it. That's bizarre. I'm trying to think of another system that did something like that. Someone in the comments is going to know if any other system did that.
The only one I can think of, and this is not a console, but the Microvision. Microvision was basically the same thing. Everything was in the cartridge.
Controls.
You literally just connected a controller.
That came to mind. Shout out Video Game Meters, 1979. We talked about that. Video Game Meters. And my one Microvision I had that you can almost see what's happening on the screen, since they're notoriously horrible in terms of
that's late 70s LCDs. Yeah. That's garbage tech. I mean, those screens are trash.
I think some people restored those, believe it or
not. Yes, there are ways to restore LCD stuff. I don't know how to do it. I used to follow a guy, and he only posted in Japanese, but I used to follow a guy who bought old Game & Watches and old like card LCD games, and he would do restoration on them. And I have no idea what he was doing, but like the process photos were fascinating to me, so I just kept following him. A lot of work, though.
So anyway, the Epoch Cassette Vision, according to this article, they sold 500,000 units for Japan. That's pretty good. Remember that population differences.
Well, and so in 81 as well, that's pretty good for it.
That's damn good. So a success here, there, but I never really heard of it. So there you go. Like the controllers look pretty cool. The controllers are on the system.
Yeah.
Paddle, little mini joystick controls. Warner Brothers. We're in the I don't want to call it. I saw some people saying we are not in a video game crash. Let's just put it that way. The interest in video games has never been bigger.
No, we're not at a video game crash. We're just back to the early 1900s where everyone just buys everything up and fucking guts it.
When you say crash, when people say we're in a crash, what they're trying to connote is that interest levels are so down you can't sell games to people anymore. That's not what's happening.
See, I haven't seen anyone call it that, but if there is, that's weird.
No.
Totally wrong.
Because that's a crash. A crash is interest is so gone you can't sell anything. Mm-hmm. The problem is the state of the AAA companies not knowing how to invest properly and not knowing how to structure their business. That's and therefore closing studios up, canceling games. That's not a crash. Well, that's them not knowing what the fuck they're doing.
EA, Sony, Microsoft, it's all they've all done the classic. Our stock is our product, not our product. And so where do we go from here? You're firing everyone. You've fired the people. You even fired and laid off people who made the games that made you money.
Correct.
So you have shown people that even doing the best they possibly can do isn't good enough. I don't know where we go from here, but we're at a tipping point.
So the Warner Brothers says they want to further invest in live service games because Suicide Squad killed the Justice League, fell short of expectations. Maybe it was a game no one wanted. That's why it fell short. Not that people didn't want a game like that, but maybe you have to market research better. I saw people get pissed. I was pissed that, they kill off Batman willy-nilly in the game, spoilers in a cutscene, for no fucking reason. And it was Kevin Conroy voicing it, so it was like extra gut punch to people because he had just died. And it was like, this is an ignoble way for Batman to go out in a game, even though it's like an Elseworld story, it was the same sort of Batman character as the trifecta of games, the Arkham games. So maybe don't do stupid fucking boneheaded decisions like that. I don't know.
Well, also, people don't want live services games anymore. Look at Avengers. That was a huge flop. They basically just took the Avengers game that Square Enix did, reskinned it and released it, and people don't want that shit. No one wants a live services game anymore. But everyone keeps trying to recreate the next Fortnite.
Like banking on a Suicide Squad game because you had a couple of quirky movies come out. It's like, is this a viable property that you can invest a ton of money on as a AAA game? I don't know, but apparently Warner Brothers rolled the dice and it didn't do as well as they hoped. So because of that, there's probably going to be more layoffs and things like that. They're delisting Adult Swim games, which boggles the mind how much that could cost them to keep those servers up. For these games that are old and not gigantic.
Tax breaks.
I don't know what it is, but Warner Brothers Discovery is like making every decision that makes you want to scream late stage capitalism. And I hate using that expression, but this is what it is. I don't, because I think it's sometimes it's misused, but this is like,
no, this is very much the definition of what that means.
We're going to kill things for no reason. Like, it doesn't make any sense.
When it doesn't make any sense anymore, you are going to lose your creatives. You're going to lose people. Because now, what are they supposed to expect? If they are not rewarded for doing well, if they are punished, if things are like, it's just, I don't know. That's got to create a very strange feeling of terror within a creative person.
All right, so it's like next 60 days. Let's see. This is small radios, big televisions. They're going to remove the game in 60 days. Another developer said they were served the same notice. So it looks like, they're going to start delisting games here and there.
It's so just absurd.
Make sure if you want those games, make sure you save them.
I've actually heard some of them are pretty good.
If people are pissed off, I'm not an Adult Swim guy. I never really followed that the titles or IPs, but
I don't think they're like licensed games. I think they're their own, like they're their own thing.
But I mean, like I'm not in the ecosystem, but I'm a lot of people are. So that sucks. You know what doesn't suck? Ultimate Nintendo Guide to the N64 Library. It's a terrible segue, but the Kickstarter has
it's not one of your best.
No, it's not. The Kickstarter for N64 Guidebook. There's only 3 days left, so get in early. Here's a little video that's going to tell you about it.
It's me, Mario. Hello.
Nintendo makes the jump to 3D. Introducing Ultimate Nintendo Guide to the N64 Library. This 450-page hardcover book contains information, screenshots, and reviews for all the games released worldwide for Nintendo's 64-bit home video game console between 1996 and 2002. Details for every Nintendo 64 game are here, including genre, release date, region, developer, publisher, number of players, game features, availability, and overall rating. Each title has a full review, as well as reflections for additional details about the game's release, historical notes, personal reviewer thoughts, and more. There are even illustrations of cartridge variants, including player's choice cartridges and international versions. The 400 full-page Nintendo 64 game reviews are only the beginning. There are additional sections dedicated to special cartridges, not for resale cartridges, and even a section for the 64DD games released only in Japan. But there is more than just games. The Nintendo 64 hardware section illustrates all the first-party controllers and accessories. There's a section highlighting some third-party accessories. And there are even sections where you can learn all about the N64 console and controller variants. This guidebook also includes articles covering topics such as Nintendo 64 technology, the history of the 64DD, N64 3D platformers, N64 wrestling games, the N64 party games, canceled N64 titles, and more. There is even a bonus mystery review section to be revealed later. From the same team that brought you the Guide to the NES Library and the Guide to the SNES Library, Ultimate Nintendo Guide to the N64 Library is a definitive resource to learn about hundreds of fun and memorable N64 titles. Are you a fan of Nintendo or retro video games? Check out Ultimate Nintendo Guide to the N64 Library. You can support this book project on Kickstarter or by pre-ordering at ultimatenintendo.com.
There you go. And remember, if you get in early, you get your name in the back of the book as an early supporter. You won't get that later on after it's released.
Hey.
You won't get that. Speaking of Warner Brothers in a weird way, Zack Snyder came up in the news again. I've got to find the article. But Zack Snyder, you know what? I almost can't be mad at the guy because he keeps saying weird things. He came out with a quote saying that the decision of Batman not killing people is mistreating Batman. Because I think his quote was something like...
He said, you're treating your character like a god in a weird way.
God in a weird way. First of all, I don't know why you think Batman's the god in the universe when it's clearly like someone like Superman who can't really be killed.
I think what he means is the writers consider Batman a god. I'm not saying a god in universe. They treat him like a god is what I think he is referring to.
But isn't it more clever to have a character that isn't forced to kill all his adversaries in order to defeat them.
At this point, I don't think it's more clever, but I don't think it's a bad thing for that character to have that. Like, it's a choice you make. Clever or not, it's a choice that's made.
No, but I mean, like, in terms of, like, okay, let's just be realistic. If superheroes really existed, there'd be no supervillains because they'd all be killed in first encounter.
Well, sure.
Spider-Man wouldn't give the Shocker more than one chance to kill him with his electros. He'd just punch him and his head would explode instantly.
Yes.
That's not interesting, though.
Well,
That's like, you can deconstruct superheroes, and when they do that, it's you know why it's a deconstruction? Because if that actually existed, it wouldn't be interesting to follow that superhero around. Like, that's why I never got into the Punisher. Like me personally, she's just killing everyone, shooting everyone in the face. Okay, that gets old, and that's not someone I look up to. That's just me. That's just me. So that's not my form of vigilante justice. So Batman. I'm not into the Batman mythos as I am for, like, Spider-Man or other characters. But the fact that Batman, his whole origin was based on the fact that a criminal killed his parents.
Yeah.
As overdone as that is, that's an essential part of the character and why he doesn't want to then just kill everyone willy-nilly. Like, that's sort of baked into the character.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think Ian and I can agree that the Batfleck version misses the mark somewhat when he just kills every henchman he comes across. When he doesn't need to, he, like, remember the one scene in the warehouse in Batman where he, like, spikes the guy's head into the fucking ground and, like, he's just wiping everyone out.
No, I don't. Because okay. I didn't watch the movie.
But it's just, I don't want to say it's glorification of cool violence, but, like, he's not Wolverine. Like, he's Batman. Like,
yeah.
He's cool to a point to me, but he's not the sort of person that he's like a silent cool because he's actually supposed to be smart and figure shit out. But that gets forgotten until the Batman movie that I finally saw from a couple years ago. It's the closest to, like, what Batman actually is out of all the Batman movies.
Oh, you finally watched it?
I finally saw it.
It's great.
It's good.
It's fucking great.
Frank hasn't watched it. I said, Frank, we got to watch it together because this is the only noirish detective Batman movie out of all the whatever, the 12 Batman movies.
That movie it took me by surprise. I fucking loved it. Thought it was awesome.
And the long time of it, you didn't even realize that it's like a 3-hour
movie. No, it's a 3-hour movie that felt like a 2-hour movie to me, to be realistic. It went way quicker than I thought. I remember Bonnie and I started it late at night, and we got up and we're like, what the fuck time is it?
And then he referenced that Batman shoots someone in The Dark Knight Returns as its basis for it. And first of all, that's a very interesting scene that he references in The Dark Knight Returns about. But if that's his only reference,
I've seen that movie a billion times. What scene?
No, not the movie, the graphic novel.
Oh yeah, sure.
When he shoots one of the bald punk people when he's holding a kid, so he'll shoot the kid, and Batman says, "I believe you," and shoots them.
Yeah.
That's a very particular instance. If you've read The Dark Knight Returns, he refuses to finish off the Joker when he encounters him. The Joker has to kill himself. So, like, Zack Snyder doesn't even know the entirety of what he's referencing, and that's what's infuriating to me.
Well, yeah.
Like, even at the end, he can't kill the Joker. At the end. Like, it's whatever. I don't want, like, Zack Snyder is frustrating because he understands things to a point, but not the entire thing. Watchmen. He understands it on, like, a fucking 12-year-old level, but not a college student level, if that makes
sense. Right, yeah.
Anything else to add? I don't know.
No. No, but just between, you know, him whining about, he's a child who, it's constantly with him, it's just, wouldn't that be cool without thinking? It goes no further than skin deep for him.
Yes.
Like, that's it.
The whole Batman getting sexually assaulted in prison.
He does not understand, like, the character.
What?
If you want to alter the character that much, make your own character. That easy.
You think Batman in prison, a guy who's like, you know, ultimate athlete, 6'4", 240, is going to, he'll do okay in prison. I'm not saying he wouldn't get hit upon by a gang or whatever. You don't want to mess with Batman in prison. I'm just saying, you wouldn't want to do that. Like, I wouldn't want to step up to Batman in prison.
Sure.
Batman Begins, he was in that prison in Asia, remember?
Mm-hmm.
And he had to deal with himself. So, no sexual assault, sorry.
Batman Begins was really good.
It was good. That was my favorite of the three. It actually was my favorite of the three movies.
It's tight.
It's
tight and succinct, and I think Cillian Murphy is fucking great as Scarecrow.
Oh, he's great. I got to see Oppenheimer. I haven't seen it yet. And then I argue with Frank. Frank loves Dark Knight Rises. I can't stand that third movie. That I cannot rewatch that third movie.
I haven't seen it. When it came out, I was like, I was in the middle of a breakup with an ex, and I just I remember not going to see it. And I know a lot of people did not like it.
Too bloated.
A lot of people did not like it. And then I want to say maybe 5 years ago, you started finding apologists for it. And I kind of want to watch it, but you know how hard it is for me to sit down and watch a movie that's longer than 2 hours. I just and it's a 3 hour movie, isn't it?
It's a long fucking movie, and it's super bloated, and Batman's barely in it, which you know, but like it's
yeah.
There's nothing detective-y about it. Go watch the new Batman movie from a couple years ago.
Yeah, if it wasn't 3 hours, I'd watch it again.
I got to watch it with Frank, because I said, Frank, we got to watch this together, because Frank always is like, yeah, noir Batman. I'm like, this is the closest to like an
Pattinson
actual
Batman. Pattinson was fucking great as Batman. Good. He was really, really better Batman than a Bruce Wayne, but I think when people complain about the movie, they complain about his Bruce Wayne, and it's like, he's kind of getting used to it.
Not enough Playboy.
Right.
The thing that Christian Bale got perfectly was like a doofus Playboy. Yeah.
I agree a little bit, but I still did. It didn't detract from the movie for me.
That derailed my train of thought there.
You know where you can get that train of thought back? At ultimatenintendo.com.
Absolutely. And you can go there and you can order RBI baseball stickers. Someone ordered, I think I tweeted out, they ordered like 10 or 20 the other week. They were like 20 of them. I'm not kidding. They were like 20 of them. See You Podcast enamel, pin, stickers, certain guidebooks. N64 guidebook can be pre-ordered as well. All at ultimatenintendo.com. The Kickstarter is ending on Thursday, Ian, and in celebration... So, I don't know. I'm going to stream myself playing N64 games.
Whoa.
With a real N64 on twitch.tv/countrycode. Go subscribe now there. And I'll be there Thursday to celebrate the end of the Kickstarter. And hopefully no one requests Carmageddon 64. Please do not. Which means they will. I can play a few races of Carmageddon, I guess. Get in early there. What do I get derailed with now? We're talking about Batman. We were talking about Zack Snyder.
We were just talking about Zack Snyder, and then at the end you said, and watch the new Batman. We were literally moving into the next topic.
Oh, I had another thought, but that's okay.
Oh, okay.
More layoffs. We talked about we're not in a video game crash, but the companies don't know what the hell they're doing. EA layoffs laid off, what was the percent of the company? 6% or whatever?
I don't know. They fired 667 employees.
5%
laid off.
5% employees globally. 5% in one fell swoop.
670 folks without a job.
They were streamlining and would deliver deeper, more connected experiences for fans. And another Star Wars game. This is like the third or fourth in the past 5 years. Major game has been canceled. Like,
I know, I can think of at least the open world one got canceled.
Yep.
The first single player one they tried to do got canceled. And this is the FPS. Those are the three I can think of. I would not be surprised if there was more.
I think they might have canceled a Battlefront game, another Battlefront.
Well, that might... This is first person.
This is the first person.
That might have been
at least
it.
Three. Anyways, at least three big games.
I'd say 3 in 3 years.
There's no small...
3 and 4.
There's no small EA Star Wars game. That's
not
the point.
Anymore.
These are all games that take multiple years.
Yeah.
And this was they canceled, I think they're going to do like a bounty hunter game, or this was going to be one. They canceled a bunch of shit. We can't keep track. It's a disaster there. They announced in December 2023, they'd be laying off staff at UK developer Codemasters. The OG Codemasters were still doing F1 games and EA sports games. Wow. So the writing's on the wall with EA. In terms of obviously cost cutting, they're no more FIFA license. They're like, fuck that. We don't need that. We're just going to do our own thing and just, you know, we don't need FIFA license. That saved them a ton of money. So I don't understand what's happening here. I don't understand why.
To the detriment of the game, but then the fucked up thing is like, where else are these players going to go? They'll complain, but they got nothing else to fucking play. So they're going to play that.
They said we are also sunsetting games and moving away from development of future licensed IP that we do not believe will be successful in our changing industry. So they're basically saying maybe less Star Wars games, I guess, even though they were the exclusive developer. They got the deal for that, whatever, years ago. I don't understand what's happening here. I think we're getting to the point of just the fact that these games are so gigantic in scope and scale and budget that they're afraid now to take these risks because they've been hurt maybe on some of these.
Yeah, maybe that's a sign that they should rein it in a little bit.
Double A. games. Single A. Not everything has to be triple A, $70, you know, 87 hours of content games. Maybe that's not the way the industry is going to work going forward. Maybe you have to be very careful about what you're putting out there and what you're risking. The same thing with movies. Like, not every movie has to be $250 million. They figured that out the past year and a half. Disney took a fucking beating between Indiana Jones and Ant-Man and the Marvels. They got destroyed last year.
The movie that I loved so much and I've talked about, I think we talked about it on here, at least on a bonus, but Godzilla Minus One had an insanely small budget. It looks fucking amazing and won best VFX. Like, you just don't need everything to be so fucking bloated.
When I watch these,
it looked better than any Marvel movie has in years.
I watched these on Twitch every Wednesday. I do these commercial streams. And one of the things that is nostalgic now are movies without IPs that are just like, hey, it's a drama about two people that are 40 years old meeting, getting together, probably cost like $7 million in 96, and people saw it and probably made back money on VHS and rentals. Where are those movies? Like, people would see movies like that if they were written well with proper stars. That's what Matt Damon said, I think, last year. Like, that the lack of physical media wiped out these smaller movies that would have been profitable and less risky for studios, and people want to see them. What's happened? Like, I think we're retracting back to a point of reason where we have to make things that cost less money in movies and, I guess, games as well. Like, why not? Well, and as long as it's fun, who cares?
It's destroyed the fucking gaming landscape, too, because, you know, it wasn't that long ago. You go back to, like, Xbox 360 and PS3, and you've got these single-A and double-A titles, as people call them. There's, you know, you have the AAA games, but you've got this, like, underbrush of all these interesting, cheaper games, all these companies making them. And now you buy a PlayStation 5, and it's like you feel like you're waiting to come out.
Waiting for like four giant games.
Because every fucking company has decided that they've got to put out the next AAA big budget fucking title. So nothing comes out at a smaller budget. So you get less games. I'm less interested because they're all fucking homogenous.
Sure.
And they're these huge projects that these studios undertake for millions and billions of dollars. And when they fail, they take less risks. You know, so it drives me nuts. And it's kind of why I've switched to PC gaming, because it used to be you would get all sorts of weird games on consoles that you would never get on PC by companies putting out, you know, a single A game a year or, you know, something like that. And now you get that on PC and you don't get it on console. It really feels like it's flipped.
I don't think these companies know how to mitigate risk anymore. They've forgotten. They just think, oh, every game's a giant game that's going to make us back a certain amount of money. If we invest $400 million, it'll make us $200 million. They have to recalculate going forward.
Especially if we put, you know, especially if we make the game about a B team, you know,
a Suicide Squad.
I
know people love Harley Quinn. I don't think if that's going to make you, you know, your billion-dollar game, her and a bunch of like DC villains no one gives a shit about. Sorry, Boomerang Man fans out there.
A Suicide Squad game could have been fun, but like but if you did it like they did the Guardians of the Galaxy game, which was single player, and a lot of people didn't play it, but everyone who played it was like, no, it feels like playing the comic, and the gameplay is good. You know, you could have done that with Suicide Squad, switch yourself between characters, play all the different little characters doing weird with their weird superpowers and whatnot. But no, it's got to be a fucking live services game.
Well, speaking of that, this is what EA says. The creator's focus allows us to drive creativity, accelerate innovation. Where's the innovation? I don't know. And double down on our biggest opportunities, including our own IP, meaning we don't have to buy anything. Sports, easy. It's the same engine almost every year. And massive online community is great. Games as a service. We're just going to lean into all this stuff.
That's not working. But they want to make the money, so they're going to keep forcing it until they find it.
No, they're making money on these things, just not enough that we have to fire people so our stock goes up for this quarter, for the fiscal year.
Because we're selling stock. That's what we're
They could have fired these people 2 months ago, 3 months ago, but they're firing them now because it was just fiscal year ends.
Fiscal year is over.
Lots of layoffs. Microsoft reveal plans to lay off 1,900 people in its gaming division.
Sony let go 1,600 people.
Oh, I saw this article had 900. It's more than that? Oh, shit.
Well, I can't read the article, but when you click on it, the headline says...
Oh, the BBC article?
The SF Chronicle one.
Oh.
Collectively laying off about 1,600 between two of their studios.
Jesus.
Yep.
Does that segue into Jeff Keighley?
I guess it does. I guess it does. We noticed that this article... on videogames.si.com, and it's basically called Gamers Deserve Better Than Jeff Keighley.
The game industry deserves a better spokesperson.
Person, yeah.
From Kirk McKeon.
And basically it starts off with like a fake artificial back and forth about this article is cutting off the 2050 Keighleys, and basically it makes fun of and says that, you know, you've got this guy who has positioned himself as the spokesperson for the video game industry, and he has done nothing to talk about the layoffs that the industry has been going through over the past few years. And his silence, especially right now, is very suspect. And it's because he needs to be an ass-kissing brown noser, because he runs the Video Game Awards show and he's beholden to them. He will lose his little pet project if he so much as speaks out about it. And,
It's more his pet project. That's his big gig. Is Summer Games and that award show.
Yeah, but he comes from fucking rich, you know, he's not in any fucking danger.
That's not the point, though. That's the way he's making his money now.
Right.
Is that, those ventures.
Yes.
He's not a journalist really anymore, right? He's not like reporting on things.
No, he's not. He's just a moneymaker. But he has positioned himself as Mr. Video Games.
Sure.
And he does not, I think it's ridiculous that he doesn't. You know, he doesn't talk about any of that.
Yeah, I'm looking at his Wikipedia right now. It's just about, Game Awards, Summer Games Fest. That's his thing. Like, that's what he's doing. That's his jobs.
He wants to be best friends with all the cool gamers and all the celebrities. And it's a weird bit of starstruckness. And I don't think his heart's in the right place. And I think it's really fucked up that, I mean, when you look at the shit that went on at the last Video Game Awards... You know, with people being played off, you know, incredibly quickly.
No Lifetime Achievement Award.
No Lifetime Achievement Award, you know, like a total of 11 minutes of acceptance speeches over a 3.5 hour thing. And then you have him conveniently just not. You hold a show that is a celebration of video games, yet you do everything you can to not talk about the problems that the people who make them are going through. And that's fucking dog shit.
Yeah, and it didn't have to be, because it's obviously it's funded by the big video game companies fund the Game Awards.
But if you're a human with a heart, you still say something. It doesn't have to be much. It doesn't have to be much. People understand Jeff Keighley's very delicate position, but he can still say, I would just like to take a moment to acknowledge and hope that everyone who has lost their job in the industry this year lands on their feet.
Sure, but I don't know if his hand, I'm not saying that he did the right thing, but maybe he brought it to them and they said, no, you can't talk about it because it makes us all look bad.
Fine.
I mean, he could have,
but I don't need to play devil's advocate for Jeff Keighley.
But here's the point. I'm the difference, I guess, between him and like Goodell being the NFL commissioner who's hired by all the NFL owners. They have a synergy between the owners and Goodell because they're all working for the same corporation. And
sure.
However, the owners don't all like each other necessarily. They have issues in between each other.
Right.
Between the 32 NFL teams. And there's divisions between them that, you know, he probably has to sort of iron out. Jeff Keighley's just a spokesperson.
Yeah, literally.
Like, he's not, he has no influence over these companies. They have all the influence over him entirely.
Yeah, like, because it's a bunch of different companies. It's not, even though it's video games is not a neat umbrella.
No. No, they were competing
with each
other.
It's still all just businesses trying to make more money than the other.
It's all just, all right, you want to show off this Sony game for 20 minutes? You better show off the Microsoft. Like, guarantee you they have talk about amount of time being shown between these companies for these different products and new games. And at some point, you have to look at yourself and be like, well, why am I supporting this Game Awards show if this is how it's run?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, what is the point? What does this Game Awards show actually, what is it doing to improve or help the industry? What, and that's an open question. I'm not saying it's nothing, but I'm actually being honest. what is it doing to support the industry?
Yeah, no, I have no idea.
Is it spotlighting, I guess, some indie games that you wouldn't know about? Maybe that's like they're throwing a bone there. But for these major games...
But they don't. I mean, they don't do that. That's the shit that all gets rushed through. And then you get, you know, a 12-minute fucking presentation with Hideo Kojima, you know, talking about emotion in computers. And
oh, is the new game's going to change?
I don't know. That game is.
So I guess that's the question. Like, because you know, you can, if you own a PS5 or Xbox Series X or whatever, you know the major games coming out. They're going to advertise them to you constantly.
Right.
When you turn on your console, it's going to say, hey, this game's coming out. Nintendo, same way. Hey, this game, the new Zelda's coming out. Like, you can't avoid it. So what is the point of the Game Awards? Because it's only, like, 10 years ago, like, was it even being watched that much? I don't think, remember bringing it up 10 years ago. But now, every year, it's a thing. So I'm not calling for people to boycott it. I wouldn't do that. But at some point, I guess it's the same thing like with the Oscars we brought up. What is it serving at that point? Is it a celebration of the industry, or is it just it's coming soon commercials for 3 hours?
It's a celebration of a few people at the top. It's an opportunity for the guy who throws it to hang out with celebrities. It's not. And that was, you know, we should really move on. But we had the longer conversation about this when the Game Awards happened. It's disturbingly not serving video games in any way, shape, or form. It's not lifting anyone up. It's not lifting up small creators. It's not letting them talk. It's just commercials for the big budget games. It serves no purpose.
All right, stop watching it. They don't make money. It goes away. That's all they can say. Then you get, I'm not saying you're going to ever get, like, why, first of all, why, I don't know why video games needs a spokesperson.
They don't.
It's like, does movies have a spokesperson? No. Does music have a spokesperson? No. You don't need a singular spokesperson for a multi-billion dollar industry.
I have learned over the past few years that
sports doesn't have a spokesperson.
That there is a subset of video game fans who cannot deal with the concept of not having some sort of big yearly video game event.
Okay.
I think that is. I remember because it made me so, I was so annoyed because I knew someone who every year would watch the E3 stuff and every year would be like, this is so shitty. Like, why did I bother watching it? And then they would spend like 6 months complaining about it. And then they would talk about how they were taking time off for the next E3. To watch the stuff.
To watch the presentations.
And that's the thing people do. And I don't get it. It's a circle where it's just something you do so you never break the cycle. And it's like, you don't even like this.
It's like their Super Bowl, basically. It's right. Like, it's their main event of the year.
When E3 started to fall apart and that first Summer of Games thing happened, there was a group of people who really, I think, just got behind Jeff and wanted to see it succeed because they needed their yearly video game thing.
Okay.
But then they complain about it. That's the thing. Every time the Video Games Awards happens, people bitch about it. People always have, you know, bitched about the last 4 years of E3 providing nothing.
Well, literally nothing the past
but
couple years.
They can't. The past few years, they cannot nothing. Stop. They cannot stop feeding into it.
Is it just, I guess, being a quote unquote, I guess you're a cultural gamer and that's your thing. Like that.
I guess that's it. I've never thought of gaming as a cultural thing. Like,
but there's some but that treat as yeah, culture. That,
it's a lifestyle. Gaming lifestyle. I play a shitload of video games, especially these days now that I don't work at Luna and I've gotten my interest back. But I've never thought of it as a lifestyle or a cultural thing. I don't buy gamer products or what. Listen to gamer podcasts.
We don't listen to our podcast, Ian?
I don't listen to any podcasts. Literally,
is this
none.
Officially a gamer podcast?
I don't know.
Well, if you want to listen to more of us. Our exclusive on patreon.com/CU podcast.
Listen to us argue about the contents of Jack in the Box tacos.
I was going to say, I do a 3.5 minute Oscars recap that Ian was amused by, including a naked John Cena, almost naked, the Willy Wonka fiasco in Scotland. And then also, we did a Jack in the Box argument and a talk about their current menu at patreon.com.
I think this really is one of the better little bonus segments. So, you know, if you've been waiting for that one to jump in on.
Ian was ready to throw bows about the mini tacos.
Pat was really giving him too much credit, but tune in. You can listen.
It's already March, but you have a small business and you got to keep moving. Stamps.com streamlines all your mailing and shipping to turbocharge your operational efficiencies. And the Stamps.com app is like a post office in your pocket. so you can stay on top of things even if you're always on the go. Use Stamps.com to print postage wherever you do business. All you need is a computer and printer. They even send you a free scale, so you'll have everything you need to get started. If you need a package pickup, you can easily schedule it through your Stamps.com dashboard. You'll save time, and time is money. Keep your mailing and shipping moving at the speed of your business with Stamps.com. Sign up with promo code CUPODCAST for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage, and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code CUPODCAST. I've been eating better recently with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to go in just 2 minutes. You'll have over 35 different options to choose from every week, including Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. I got myself some keto meals. The chicken with mushrooms was delicious, and the chili was good too. There are more than 60 add-ons to help you stay fueled up and feeling good all day long. What are you waiting for? Get started today and get after your goals. Fuel up fast with Factor's restaurant-quality meals that are ready to heat and eat whenever you are. Discover a wide variety of easy options for the entire day. They have breakfast, midday bites, and more. Factor meals are ready to heat and eat, so there's no prepping, cooking, or cleanup. Get as much or as little as you need by choosing your meals every week. Plus, you can pause or reschedule your deliveries at any time. Factor is the perfect solution if you're looking for fast, premium options with no cooking required. They've done the math. Factor is less expensive than takeout, and every meal is dietitian approved to be nutritious and delicious. Head to factormeals.com/CUPODCAST50 and use code CUPODCAST50 to get 50% off. That's code CUPODCAST50 at factormeals.com/CUPODCAST50 to get 50% off.
This portion of the CU Podcast is brought to you by Raycon and their everyday earbuds. Raycon is on a mission to prove that you shouldn't have to pay an arm and a leg for quality sound and essential smart tech listening features. It's a no BS product. Thanks to Raycon, you're paying half the price for the same, if not better quality, earbuds. Raycon doesn't outsource the design and development of their earbuds. Their small but mighty team of design audio engineers cut their teeth at brands like Bose and Peloton.
Raycon stands by their products. They have an easy and free return guarantee and over 50,000 five-star reviews. The everyday earbuds have features like noise isolation, awareness mode. They have custom gel tips for a perfect, comfortable in-ear fit. They fit perfectly in my big ears, Ian. They're also water resistant. You can work out in them fine. And 8 hours of playtime for the everyday earbuds. I've had earbuds in the past that lasted less than an hour. Not an issue with the Raycon Everyday Earbud.
Support the podcast. Click the link in the description box or go to buyraycon.com/CUPODCAST15 to get 15% off your Raycon purchase. That's 15% off your Raycon purchase by going to buyraycon.com/CUPODCAST15 or clicking the link in the description on YouTube.
All right, Ian.
Yes.
you said
I'm
that
a little out of breath.
Another Heritage Auction signature video game auction happened. They do video game auctions almost every week, but
signature
once a month. I get the mailers, so I know they're coming. Once a month, they do like these are our primo collection this time out, and
all the big hitters, the big name titles.
I did the harrowing job of cataloging the Biggest Losers, but also a nice state of where things are at when you start to really dive in to the data here. And this is comes of course on our heels last month. On the heels of us talking about the class action lawsuit curling against WADA and the collusion and Dennis Kahn's deposition. Go check out that video if you haven't. We laid out in Dennis Kahn's own words why the $100,000 Super Mario Brothers sale that started this entire speculative bubble was likely a sham, which we knew. But in his own words, he says, yes, it's a sham. So go check it out here. So you want to start with the Biggest Losers or the most interesting stuff here? What would you rather do first, Ian?
Let's go with the interesting stuff.
Interesting things here that happens. Because throughout the glut of just sealed garbage that people are trying to pump up, like their version of NFTs, there are some actual rare, interesting items that get inserted here and there.
Oh, my God. Oh, my stomach. the Game & Watch Mickey Mouse Panorama, what condition was that in?
It was in pretty good condition. And you can look it up. Why?
Because I had one a long time ago. I sold it for about $150.
But it wasn't sealed, though.
No, it wasn't.
Sealed!
It was not.
First of all, there's this item that used to always come up 15 years ago, 20 years ago, and all like the rarest video games. And that was Ultima Escape from Mount Dratch for the VIC-20. I know all you VIC-20 fans out there, you know, you were chomping at the bit. But for some reason, they did not produce that many of them. I have never seen one in person, personally. Maybe I saw a cassette in person, not the box.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This went for $3,100, and I mean the box is destroyed.
It is. It's gross.
But
also, weirdly published by Sierra.
Yeah, Sierra.
Yeah.
Yeah, they publish some games here and there on consoles and things.
No, I just mean the fact that it's Ultima. I just thought that was odd.
That may be one of the reasons why they didn't produce that many of them.
Yeah.
But it's always brought up, like all those lists, like NWC cart, Mr. Boston on the Vectrex, which I still want one, by the way. I almost bought one years back. So that was a weird one. An NWC, a 6.5 NWC cart with badges and a receipt, went for $84,000. It seems to be that the NWC carts have settled into this price range, 50, 60, 100, a little more, for varying degrees for these. For the gray ones, obviously, the gold ones haven't gone off in forever. There hasn't been a gold public sale in 15 years, it seems like, at this point. So that was an interesting one. I thought this would go for maybe a little more, because I don't know, the individual patches aren't worth much, but sometimes you get the ephemera attached, and it's like, oh, this is right. Cool. You know, having the receipt, I think, is just funny there. Tecmo Bowl prototype for $2,200. That's interesting because that didn't seem overly inflated. A popular third-party NES game prototype going for a couple grand isn't shocking to me, even though it might have been just a sample, not a prototype, but whatever.
Right.
The things I like the best are like the Mario Power merchandising jacket and Mario and Yoshi jackets. They went for about several hundred each. Star Fox Weekend cart went for $7,500. Moving on, a sealed Superman for Atari went for $4,800. LOL, I wrote down in my notes. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Ridiculous for that. Legend of Zelda test cart went for $5,500. Those have always gone for the most expensive of all the test carts.
Yeah.
I'm always very wary of those. I've literally had someone in person at a convention say, hey, Pat, I just bought this. Verify that this is real. And I say to them, I do not know.
Right.
Because the problem with those carts for both that and the Duck Hunt, the boards are identical.
Yeah.
So in theory, for a Legend of Zelda, you can peel the label off of a regular Legend of Zelda, get the board of a regular one, as long as you have a test cart,
yeah,
a cheaper yellow test cart, slap it in, and it's now worth $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 more.
Right.
That's the problem with those. And the one I looked at, I felt bad because there was bubbling on the label, which is a lot of times an indication that it was taken off and reapplied.
Yes.
So I didn't say it was fake. I said, I don't know. I'm not the person.
Right.
I just felt weird. So if you can somehow they verified it was real, God bless them. I don't know a way to do it. There's like no definitive way that I've heard of that you can verify one of those. It's like a crapshoot on those. That you're not just buying another cheaper test cart with swapped labels and boards.
Right.
On there. Stadium events, 18,600. I tell you what, that plucky Stadium events, just card only, it's still going for a lot. Like, there's still, I guess, people trying to complete their collection or make a keepsake.
Well, at this point, it's different from other genuinely rare games, I think, because it's popular. It's known. It's probably, I would say, after all sorts of shitty, misleading news articles over the years and this, that, and the next thing, I would say of the rare video games, that's probably the most, I would say that's the one that's closest to a household name. Not that any are, but I would say among video game collectors, Stadium events is probably the most,
it's known.
It's one of them, you know, that if you ask someone, they're probably going to say like that Panzer Dragoon Saga. Like these are the ones that I think everyone knows of.
You think
as
it's on
like,
that list?
Yeah. As of like a top.
Congratulations.
Top
crappy game. You broke through. And then this one was interesting to me. 26,400. A Super Mario Brothers, the Famicom one sealed. The Famicom one, not the NES. And that's interesting because I don't recall Famicom games being auctioned off for that much money in the past. I am not an expert on Super Famicom, regular Famicom games and how they're sealed and whatnot. That's just interesting to me. I don't have much thoughts about that. I would just say this. If you're an American collector getting into Famicom, I'd be really careful because you don't know what the hell's out there in Japan. Like, you don't know what the state of the market is. You don't know how often they come up. That's all I have to say about that. But that is interesting because that's actually the country of origin.
Right. And I was going to say, it's interesting because Japan doesn't... The collector scene in Japan is entirely different than what it is over here. Mm-hmm. They tend to move on. And, you know, and people can correct me, but at least when I was looking into it maybe 10 years ago about why the import market is cheaper, one, it's, you know, they produced tons and tons of this stuff when it was popular over there. But the other thing is just that there really isn't much of a retro game collecting scene over there. Now, that may have changed, but I know 10 years ago, it's not that it doesn't exist. It's just in a very different form and smaller than it is here.
That makes sense. And then a few more, a Max Rifle for $7,500. Yeah, I see them offered at conventions for $5,000 or $10,000 in there, so that's not shocking.
Is that the vibrating light gun?
No, the M16, the one that the army used to train.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Yeah, because it's like super precise. If you actually, I tested one at a convention a year or two ago. Well, I've held them, but yeah, they're chunky.
I got to play with the feedback one, but I didn't get to play with that.
There was a feedback one?
Oh yeah, the guy had it. There's one with there's a rapid fire like feedback. He had it at Long Island. I told you to go check it out. It was like 2 years ago.
Or maybe then I played it there and forgot.
I think that's what it was.
I forgot.
I don't think it was the Max M16 because I told you to go play that.
Oh, you're talking about the Konami one that came out in Japan. You're talking about the Famicom Konami machine gun.
Uh-huh.
This is an actual M16 like army training thing, the Max Super Nintendo.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. This was interesting. Sealed second and third gen iPhones for 3.3 and 3.6K.
I thought I saw a Gen 1 iPhone on there too.
I didn't see it. What's interesting about that is this. There are Apple collectors out there.
Oh, there definitely are.
But for phones that were made in quantities so incredibly large that they didn't sell all of them, you know that. And there has to be sealed ones of every generation laying around. I mean, these are phones they made hundreds of millions of, some of these.
So there's a first generation iPhone here that sold for $21,600 that auction. However, immediately there's a make offer to owner for $27,000 or more button underneath.
That's not my market. I'll just say these are, I mean, we talk about mass produced between games and iPhones. The step up is gigantic at that point.
Maybe not so for the lower gen, the earlier
for the ones or twos.
For the ones or twos. By three, especially 3S. 3S is when everyone adopted the iPhone.
iPhones were sold.
I feel like 3S is like, at least everyone I knew was finally getting an iPhone.
Okay, there was less. First gen was only 6 million.
But it is less.
6 million, yes. 6.1. So maybe by second and third, the jump ups don't make sense anymore in terms of the amounts.
Right.
You're right. Maybe first gen, get in early. 6.1 is, I mean, there's still sealed ones out there.
Yes.
That's what it says. That's sales. That's not produced. That says sales. They produce more than that. So we'll see. Okay, what's next here? Oh, and then we'll get into this later, but this is how I know the bubble. I don't want to say burst because it's still coming back down. Random third-party NES seal games we used to laugh at the prices from 2 or 3 years ago. Those have come down to earth on some of them. Like, you're not seeing $8,000 Star Voyagers anymore.
No.
Like you were.
No.
So, a couple of examples here that I have here that, Ian, I have the pictures of some of these there.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the exact, and I mean the exact same ones. I went and checked, saw the back of the case picture and look at the serial number for the water grade. Felix the Cat went from 10.2 thousand in July 2021. You know that hot IP Felix from the 1950s, it went down to 2.4K past month. It's an 80% drop. 80% drop. And that's still, and I love that game. They gave it a positive review in a certain Skybuff.
It's a fun game.
It's not a $10,000 game. It's not a $2,000 game seal. It's not a rare game. Last Action Hero halved in price. Same one. I didn't even report the price because it probably didn't matter that much.
No.
That's actually a very uncommon game. That's interesting to me. That
one is, but again, I mean, if you look at the stuff that we talked about earlier, the interesting stuff, you know, it's not...
There's less risk taking.
The stuff that is genuinely interesting goes for less than the fucking sealed, more common stuff. And that's always been the weird thing that's happened since the rise of sealed gaming to me, is that the genuinely rare things, yes, they're still expensive, especially for the average person, but compared to what people are getting for a fucking common game that just happens to be sealed in a box, it's insane to me that a Star Fox Weekend cart is 7.5K. But a Final Fantasy sealed for the NES is more than that at 7.8K. It's just insane to me.
Yeah. And then lastly, an actually rare NES game, Swordmaster.
Yes.
It was 15.6K, and I would have said that's too much money back then, in October 21, down to 5K. So that's a drop, Pat Math, of like 70% or so. So we're not at the pre-bubble prices yet.
No.
But on this trajectory, we may get there in the next year or so. If these come up often enough, and again, a lot of these are the same one where they're dumping games. These folks realize, I got head. I'm taking a big loss on these.
Oh, yeah.
I'm an idiot. Right. I might have, maybe E and I invested in 20 or 30 games. I'm out $200,000 or
more. Maybe my neighbors are too.
I'm a dentist. I'm out seven figures. If I'm Mr. Nierman.
I'm out convincing my friends by and the way, neighbors.
I didn't bring this up, and I'm actually trying to be sympathetic to the good doctor. When he found out about the orchestration of the Super Mario Brothers sale for $100,000, I wonder what he thought about it. Would he have started an LLC and got friends and neighbors to invest in a business venture to invest in SEAL games? If he had known that, maybe that SEAL wasn't on the up and up. I don't know. I'm just saying. Just put it out there. Now, let's get to the biggest losers here for this. Yeah. Big losers. Big losers, Ian.
Big losers.
The Legend of Zelda. So, a 9.0 early production. Not first production. Early production. In July, literally the height of this. July 2021 was the $1.5 million Mario 64. That's when the sale happened to Collector's Universe of Water Games. That was the watershed moment for this. So it went for $870,000 back in July 2021. An actual first production, 8.0, from October 2021. I'm not sure that's the one Danielle bought that she bragged about. $705,000,
right,
in October 2021. $705,000. Well, another one in the same condition, 8.0 first production, came up February, $288,000. Pat, that's a lot of money. Not when it was for $700,000 before.
Right.
It dropped more than 50%.
And that's the thing. People, I think some people might look at these numbers and go, well, that's still a lot of money. It's like, you don't understand. People bought at the higher price.
Yes.
They can't, like, okay, sure, in general, that object is worth a lot of money, but that's a loss to them.
And if another one comes up, it might be less than that when they realize the one before. That's what happens in some of these markets. It's an effect. It's like, uh-oh. There's no more FOMO. This is what happens. Next one is the Super Mario Brothers 2, which always beguiled me for one that went for so much money in terms of it being sealed, especially since it's not a game that has a legacy outside of its own insular game. You know, like, I just think that's a funny one versus...
What do you mean by that?
Like, it's its own, like, Mario's dream. Like, there was no other game made like that.
Oh, sure, sure, sure. Yeah.
They never like, built off of Mario 2. Like, they did 3 and 4, like, are basically connected to World to 3, you know? So, a 9.8 plus first production. So, this is, like, the top of the line. October 2021, $324,000. Recently, $114,000, a loss of $210,000. That's a loss, Pat Math, of about 60-something percent right there. We're just talking people, like, losing. I didn't even check to see if that one was the same copy. I think I might have, or maybe it wasn't. But that's, like, you are losing houses right now.
Yeah.
You are losing properties.
Yeah, if you were stupid enough to use this as an investment, you are fucked.
Super Mario Brothers 9.2 B+ sealed later production. Which, okay. $40,000
to 8K.
To 8K.
Just wiping out the value.
and that's going to dive even low. Now let's get to the Pokemon ones. So when we talked about this, I always thought it was funny because, like, the bubble was an increase in card collecting, sports cards, and the Pokemons and things like that, along with these games that would come up in these auctions. It was probably almost like a lot of the same collectors were getting into both, not realizing that, you know, Game Boy games from the late 90s, early 2000s are not rare, even finding them sealed, you know? Like, what? And Game Boy Advance, which we're going to get to as well. So, Pokemon Blue, 9.4 A++, extra plus. Same copy. I checked the numbers. Went from 96,000 at the peak, July 2021, down to 33.6, a loss of negative 62.4K. It's doing the math for me. That's probably about 65%. About.
Yeah.
And then the Pokemon Yellow halved in price from 18,000 to 9,000.
When was that one initially sold?
I didn't check. It might have been the same. Maybe it was the same person got them all. I didn't check in.
I would just find a yellow going for, if it was 2021, I would find a yellow going for that much less than a blue to be odd. That's
maybe it was a little bit later. Maybe it was like last year.
Yeah, but still.
These are even better because these are newer. These are Game Boy Advance. Now you're in the 2000s. We always say, once you get to the 2000s with sealed games, I would not touch anything. Once you get 2000s.
Just wait and see.
Because you don't know how many are out there. People are now collecting for real. A lot more established game collectors that are holding on to this shit.
Yeah. No, absolutely. We're in that era where, like, now you've entered the era where collecting is a thing, so you have no idea what the actual amount is. People could be holding on to these.
It's like 70s for sports cars and 80s when people are starting to hold on to everything.
Right.
Nothing past the 60s is like rare for sports cards. And like, it's just not, because those are the kids that grew up having them thrown out. I'm keeping everything now. So same thing with that. Pokemon Sapphire, 9.8 plus, April 2021, 50,400, down to 15,15.6, a loss of almost $35,000. Holy shit. Very similar proportionate drops. What you're talking about, which is like 60s to 70% range, a lot of these. All right, let's get to our good old N64. There's a couple examples here. And I think they have a big N64 one coming up.
Oh, like specifically just N64?
Their next signature auction says 8 to 64 bit. I dare you to auction off a high-end Mario 64.
If that Mario 60, yeah, holy shit. I dare you.
Or a high-end Mario Kart. But here's a couple. You had an 8.5A Super Mario 64 from 31,000 down to 3.4. Holy shit. We're talking now you're getting to like 90% losses here. A Final Fantasy VII misprint. This was always one that boggled my mind that you would get into these.
Misprints?
Yeah, because those were not super rare, those misprints. I had one.
Sure. Some things that are considered misprint, like I love to see an auction for Strider 2 go up on eBay because they're always like misprint rare. I think every copy of Strider 2 that was released in the US was that misprint.
I didn't know that.
Okay. Strider 2, there's a disc with Strider 1, and then there's a disc with Strider 2, and Strider 2 is on the Strider 1 disc, and Strider 1 is on the Strider 2 disc.
They just printed the wrong thing.
Yeah, I think that's all of them, but you always find someone. I even had someone come into the store once try to trade one. They're like, I think mine might be really rare because the games are on the wrong disc. I'm like, man, that's all of them.
All right, so Final Fantasy VII 9.8++ went from, well, first of all, a 9.8A+ worse condition went for 33,600. This better condition one went for only 15. It's not going, the better condition one goes for half of the last one, less than half. It's negative 18,000. Super Smash Brothers 9.4A+. This one is interesting to me.
The Smash?
Yeah, because an A++ went for 144,000 when July 2021 when we were like, this is nuts. One went for 72,000 January 2022. This one says this one went for only 7,800, a drop of about $137,000 since the height. the auction, Ian, said box printed in USA. I looked at it and I was like, box printed in USA. I looked on the boxes. I looked at both auctions, the one that went for 144, the one that went for 7.8. The boxes to me look identical. And the WADA details on the front label with the details were identical. So I don't know if they were trying. I'm not saying they're trying to manufacture a difference of why this is going for a lot less, but it was a huge drop. It might have been an error in the listing, but it was a drop. I don't give a shit about the extra plus, whatever. I still have yet to see the difference between an A plus and an A plus plus that makes sense.
Well, it doesn't have to make sense to you, though. But it just has to make sense to the idiots buying it.
Oh, sure. But is that plus worth $136,000?
I mean, probably not.
So anyway, that was a weird one. And now going to back to these NES games. Battletoads 9.88 A+. It was the same copy, Ian, with different photos. I looked at the photos and I was like, huh.
Weird.
It looks like just on the surface, it looks to be the same. Like I saw a crinkle. I looked at the numbers in the back. Same copy. 40,800 down to 13.2. A loss of 37,600. So they took pictures of that, which means it definitely left their offices and came back probably. I'm not saying they're trying to hide some of these by taking different photos versus not, but I think we're at the point now where these people are starting to dump these, and it's obvious when they're the same copies 2 years later, 3 years later.
It means that these are the people who bought into it bullishly, and now 2-3 years later, they're like, well, this was a bust.
Yes. Saw it with the Felix the Cat, the Final Fantasy, the Last Action Hero, the Swordmaster. So I guess the question is, the people now buying in, do they think they're getting a bargain? Now the prices will go back up. Are they actually collectors that actually want these things? Or do they think that, you know, the market's solidified and now they're going to go up eventually again? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like it would be very, I feel like anyone who's treating this as a buy the dip situation is too far gone.
But you know that the people that are dying in the wool are saying buy the dip.
Oh, I know.
Because I can't fathom these games. Well, if it was worth $200,000 2 years ago, why is it only worth $30,000 now?
No, we told everyone this is worth stuff, you know, so that's what we're going to do. It's worth stuff, so we're just going to keep trying.
Is it still correcting?
Yeah,
I was told a year and a half ago when I was confronted at PRGE.
It was a market correction.
I was told it was just a correction. Is it still a correction when it keeps going down a year and a half later? How long does it correct for? Years? A decade? What is a correction, a crash? Like what is that an actual, like, is there a definition of that? I just want to know. Because if it keeps dropping 70% year over year, like, is that still a correction? I don't know. All I know is this. Some of the NES games I saw were now, like some of the random third-party seal ones, were struggling to crack $1,000 again.
Right.
Which is where a lot of this stuff kind of was.
Yes.
5 years ago, before it got pumped up. Which is always like, oh yeah, back to the point of, well, yeah, seal games are interesting to the average collector. But so maybe they garner anywhere from, you know, 2 to 10 times over a complete in box, somewhere in that range, depending on, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
somewhere in that range, not 100 times, not 50, not 1,000 times. And I'm not saying that's happening for every single game, but we're starting to trend back in that direction for some of these because the sellers are getting out and it's obvious they got taken for a ride. So,
I don't know. It's. Like I said, the prices are still high enough that I think there are some people out there who can maybe be conned into, you know, thinking that buying a dip is a good idea. But I don't know. You have all of the people who initially started doing this selling off their stuff. You're going to lose the cheerleaders. And once you lose the cheerleaders, then where's the interest supposed to come from? Then you're just going to go back to regular collecting.
Yeah, because the people that are dumping the stuff, they got conned into buying, basically.
They're not going to stick around.
They're not, and they can't cheerlead because they just realize I lost a ton of money.
Right. So who's left to keep pushing? Yeah. When something comes up this inorganically, there's not going to magically be people to fill that vacuum.
Yeah, the original owners that sold this, they made their money. Some cheerleaded, some didn't. The people that sold all those Atari games that they're no longer auctioning off, holy shit, you just you you fathom money out of thin air,
yeah,
selling worthless Steel Guitar games for $10,000 each is still, to me, one of the most incredible things I've ever witnessed.
It's kind of crazy.
People losing money over entirely worthless Atari games that nobody wants.
Yeah.
And I mean nobody. Like, that's insane. That's going to be funny once all those Spider-Men start being dumped, the Atari
God, the entire Spider-Mans. Yeah. Did you actually look any of those up?
They did an auction, a ton of Ataris. There was like less than 10. Trust me, I'll look out for Spider-Man. I'm on the lookout.
Okay.
The next time we podcast, I'll look some up just to see the drop from 10,000 down to where they should be, like $30 on there. And that's all I want to say. I'm going to editorialize this just a slightly little bit here. When the enthusiasm on the reporting side that we saw in 2019 and 20 and 21 on these exorbitant prices from major news outlets and games reporters. Why are you silent now?
Right.
Why is there silence? Isn't this just as big of a story of a market tumbling into oblivion over the past now, you want to say 2 years at least? It's just been receding or saying, why is that not news? Why is that not in the interest to report that? Is it because you got fooled into reporting it originally being on the rise? You didn't ask enough questions. You didn't look into things. I just think it's a shame that you have such cheerleaders for these things that might have been, I don't want to say foolish to look away, but we're so caught up in the frenzy that now that reality sets in, they don't want to report on it at all.
Yeah. I feel like if you're a reporter, you report both. I mean, if you're a reporter and you're reporting on something that you like and you report both the excitement, you should also report the failure.
Yeah. And it's okay to say, hey,
we were wrong.
We were wrong, or we didn't look into this hard enough, because a reporter is supposed to report facts. They're not just supposed to regurgitate PR pieces. They're not supposed to regurgitate, what's in the best interest of the person talking to you. It was in the best interest of Dennis Kahn and Heritage Auctions to say, hey, that $100,000 Super Mario sale on the up and up, or hey, all these exploding prices, this seems all natural, and it's the market catching up to where comics were in like the past 20 years.
Right.
And if you do that without offering a counter voice, and this all drops now, and people literally losing six figures or seven figures on these games and not reporting it, you're doing a disservice to yourself. That's all I'm saying. I don't want to call it individuals. You know who you are, but you're doing yourself a disservice, because it doesn't harm the video game industry to ignore this. Well, actually, no, it does harm it. It didn't harm it when you didn't look into it to yourself, but now it's harming it because now it's all tumbling down. So
I don't know if I worded that correctly.
I think it's going to come across.
So there you have it.
All right. Well, yeah, I don't know. I want to see where I wish I could fast forward and see where it is in a year.
I don't think it's going to be higher.
No, neither do I. I just think it would be fun to fast forward and see where it is in the year.
I've never witnessed in real time before a market collapse. Like, go from game worth $1,000, we'll just say Super Mario 64, we'll just say it's worth $1,000 sealed. That might have been even crazy 6-7 years ago. Now it's 1.5, and where is it going to drop back down to? We'll just see. We know, okay, so last one was 300,000 or so we'll see what it comes back down to.
Moving on, we're doing a little bit of a clickbaity topic. We're going to talk about...
You ruined it by saying it's a clickbait topic.
You said that in the intro. You said it in the intro.
You're right, Ian.
I'm just fucking repeating what you said. Jesus, Dad. Six things you should know before collecting retro games. We haven't done one of these in a while.
Six things. We're going to take a picture of us holding up games like with our mouth open. You know, when you get into collecting...
Please close your fucking mouths and your goddamn... Jesus, it's so bad. It's so bad. Why do people open their mouths and thumbnails?
Right, there goes our intro to our topic. But so before you get into collecting retro games, you can be caught off guard, or you don't know the ins and outs of what to look out for. So these are six things you should know before you start collecting retro games. Number one, Ian.
Budget correctly. This is a big one, and it's, I think it, it's going to be a big make or break when you're looking at a system. Not all systems are equally priced. Not all are cheap. You don't have a lot of money. Collect Atari. NES collecting is getting, you know, just for games, somewhat reasonable again. Prices are going back down. You can pick up the stuff you like. Super Nintendo, Genesis, cheap systems, relatively, to collect for at a base level, compared to some of the other big boys. Saturn, never cheap. Never will be cheap.
TurboGrafx,
not cheap. Dreamcast, consistently getting more and more expensive every day, especially the good games. And, you know, those are great systems. But if your goal is to, if you just, there are people who just kind of collect to display. So if you're just collecting, if you want to own the system and maybe a couple of representative games, you know, to put on a shelf, and then you can, you know, mod a system or whatever. Yeah, then something like the Saturn is fine. You know, you'll drop a couple $100, get yourself a nice system, a couple of games, put them on a shelf. But if you're actually going to be playing the system that you want to collect for, you want to collect, you know, a chunk of a library, yeah, just, you know, think about it. Because a lot of people who get into collecting, I saw it all the time at Luna, you know, people would buy a Saturn, they'd get real excited to see one, and they'd come back, and it's not just us, they'd just be like, man, all I can play on this fucking thing is sports games, because, you know, sure, even the shitty games at this point, you know, are becoming more and more expensive. You know, a copy of Sonic 3D Blast should not be however much it is. It's probably at least 60 to 100.
Sure.
And I like Sonic 3D Blast, but, like, that's insane.
In general, like, you stick with those cartridge systems that there's a ton of games for, that, you know, there's a lot more out there in general. So, like, NES, there are so many common games on the NES that are like $10 still probably or less that are actually fun to play. That you can, you pick them up, you play them, you don't feel like you have to save up $150 to play a game like Ninja Gaiden, you know? So know the system you're getting into. And if you want to try, like, pre-NES systems, because they're mostly cheaper, you know, you want to try the Atari 2600 or the Intellivision, you can buy up probably two-thirds of the library without spending a grand. You know, like, conversely, like, you can go out there and buy a lot of these games and have a ball and experiment. So just know your base console, what the, like, common sort of game price is for that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, yours is next.
Number two. Patience. It's a virtue, not just in life, but when you're collecting anything. So a lot of people, when they collect, think of it as a race, unfortunately, where they have to gobble up everything as soon as they can.
Well, and there have been people who have treated it as that way. I mean, we saw that in the mid-2000s,
early 2000s.
Like the 2015, 2016, we saw 2014. We saw a lot of people who got into collecting, who, you know, were probably, you know, they were like 25, made a lot of money in whatever job they got out of college, and they were literally going online and just buying whole collections, you know, off of eBay. Within, you know, 2 months of shipping from various places, they had their fully formed Nintendo collection.
Sure. So if you have that money, you can do that. That's not as problematic in terms of that, unless you get buyer's remorse, which happens sometimes. But this goes into the budget a little bit. The more patience you have, the more likely you will not to overspend. Most items that you encounter in video games are super mass-produced products for the consumers, most. Mm-hmm. So it's not like you'll never see these items again. Even an item that is rare, you will come across again at some point. It's just a matter of when. So this happened to me in my journey, where I held out buying certain games for years because I knew I could find a savings, or I can get a better deal, or I could maybe find someone to trade with. And I would definitely, especially if you're on a budget, you have to be patient. If you're not comfortable spending on something, you can wait it out, because either you'll find a better price, or maybe you'll be in a better position where you'll feel more comfortable spending down the road. That happened to me as well. I was at a point when I first moved to San Diego, there's no way I was going to shell out that amount of money for the Panesian games.
No.
I did not have a great job. I didn't have a lot of savings, but later on I could spend on the Panesian games. I was in a better spot, you know, several years later. It took me about several years to get all three.
Well, and not only were you in a better spot financially, but by waiting a long enough time, you ended up finding a better deal on them than you probably would have.
Maybe. But the point is, like, there was no rush.
Right. There is.
Even some of me that was going for a complete set, I could wait. I could afford to wait. It didn't make me feel incomplete there. And yeah, don't buy more to save. I've been a person that this has happened to myself where, you know, if you see a deal, if you cannot afford it, it's not a deal, really.
Yeah.
You know, like, if you're not comfortable spending $300 in a game that's usually $350, why don't you wait until you're more comfortable spending $350 on it? Like, it's okay to do things like that.
Sure.
Don't feel like you're forcing yourself to spend at the current moment to save hypothetical money you might not spend later on.
Yeah, don't get into the, it's like stealing sort of mindset.
Don't buy more to save all the time, but sometimes it makes sense, but not all. All right, number three.
So this is actually just kind of like two sub tips, but this is more if you're buying to play and not just to collect. I find that there is a large number of people forgetting that you can try before you buy with emulation. Emulation and collecting, and this, I've been saying this since the early 2000s, emulation and collecting go hand in hand because you can try the games you want first and make sure you're not buying something stupid. It's a great way to make sure you're buying something that you like.
The modern rental system.
And you're actually going to play. The other big thing if you're buying to play and not to collect is 100% always, always, always look at the import market. Expensive games for the NES, cheap on the Famicom. Expensive games for the Game Boy, lots of them cheap in Japan. PC Engine, 100%. The expensive games for the TurboGrafx are much, much cheaper if you're buying the PC Engine version. So where doesn't this work? This doesn't work if your favorite genre is, you know, role-playing games. If you're an RPG collector or something like that, obviously that's not, it's not as viable of a pathway. But platformers, action games, all of the stuff that was most popular, shooters during, like, in retro gaming, you know, the quick pickup and play games are mostly playable if you buy the import, and you'll save yourself a ton of money.
Number four, sellers aren't always experts. You'll find on your journey, you'll encounter sellers of all variety and sorts, whether they work in stores, at flea markets and swap meets, at gaming conventions. They are not always experts. So one of the things that I wrote down here was you have to study. If you're a game collector, you have to put in work. Like, it's homework in a way to understand each game console is its own unique ecosystem of what's interesting, what's good, what's rare, what is odd. You have to actually, like, put in homework. And to someone like Ian and me, it's not homework because we were, like, gradually introduced to it.
Well, yeah.
By osmosis. Mm-hmm. But if you're just, like, if I had to start off today collecting NES games, a library of 800 games, and knowing the ins and outs of what's good, what's bad, what's rare, I would not know where to begin. I would be lost.
Absolutely.
You would have to go to, I guess at this point, if there's forums left, there's no modern TSR NES archive, but go to YouTube videos and look at hidden gems videos and things like that. So there's a lot you have to know for each particular console. I don't want to say a sub point for this is maybe focus on one console until you're comfortable before getting into multiple. If you can do that.
But that's just going to be that's a personal preference, but I've always found it a lot more fun to collect deeply for few consoles than to collect broadly for many.
Sure. But sellers aren't always experts. I've encountered sellers, even, you know, obviously I know a bit about game collecting, but there is stuff I do not know. But for example, I will say there was an incident, not an incident, but my friend was looking for a very rare Atari game at a convention. He found one. He came to me and said, "Hey, Pat, is this authentic or is this a reproduction?" And I said to him, "I think this is a reproduction, but I'm not positive. The problem is the answers we were getting from the seller did not give us any confidence that they even knew." So I said, stay away.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Stay away from this. We're talking about a, you know, $1,000 game, not $100, not $200.
Right.
So I was like, stay away. So sellers may not always know, because the more sellers I encounter, I'm an old man now, they're younger than me. So they got into game collecting at a younger age. And for the amount of time it takes to really get up and knowledgeable on multiple systems, let alone if you're selling games, you got to know a little bit of every system. It's a lot to learn.
Sure. So sellers
will bluff about that sometimes. Some will say they don't know. A lot won't. You have to watch out. Ask other sellers. Excuse me. Ask collectors that have been in the game for a long time if you're not sure about a major purchase. Number five.
Buy in lots, if possible. This kind of hand in hand goes. I think it's harder to find lots in the U.S. now than it used to be.
Oh yeah,
finding lots in Japan though, really not that difficult. However, if you can buy in lots, do it. And by lots, I mean, you know, you're paying just for a big box of whatever the person's selling, and you're not being picky about what's in there. So this is a good tool whether you're buying to play or buying to put them on your shelf. If you're buying to play, you end up with tons of doubles you can use as trade bait, potentially trade-ins to you know, any local shops that you have. Sales. And if you're buying to collect, I mean, buying in lots is the easiest way to check off like 200 items in your list if you want to, because you'll end up with all of the most common games. No one leaves their house in the morning being like, I can't wait to go find bases loaded 1 through 3, but you know, you'll get them in your lots.
Yeah. And I don't know how much the bots from the big, like, Lukey games ruined this. And Jay, you know, because we did this as a topic several years ago, it was found out that bots were separate buying accounts for these big, the big three or four, like DK oldies.
Oh yeah,
were buying lots up by, they were calculating and buying up lots. That probably, they gamed the system, because then any deals that you might have found were going to just be diminishing returns. So I don't know if that happens anymore on eBay. Someone in the comments, let me know if you can still find like NES. Like, it used to be like, here's 20 NES games for, you know, $25,
right?
And it could have been $40 worth of games, $50. You know what I mean? Like, you could get ahead. I don't know if that's a thing anymore. But in person, it is. You can still go to swap meet, game stores. You can go to conventions. You can bundle and save there. Again, if you're comfortable with your budget. And number six, making friends.
Number of the beast.
What?
You said six. Six, oh, six. Did I? The number of the beast.
Making friends in the retro gaming hobby is key. It's key to life, Ian. It's key to the success as well. You get leads. When you talk to the collectors, what is the first thing comes up? Do you have this? Have you heard of this? Hey, I'm looking for this. They know other collectors. They can lead you to a deal, or at least making friends, handshakes. That's how I got my M82 demo unit. I knew someone, and you know, that's how I got the M8. Like, you know someone who knows one, and you get put people together that are crazy enough to spend the amounts of money I spent on those pieces of plastic. That's how that works.
That's how you got your NWC.
Because I knew Ian, and I didn't treat him like trash. And he reached out, and I verified it was real in front of, but both of us did, and we all did.
But yeah, I mean, which I added a little piece just to your number six here is, befriend your local video game store employees. Don't be creepy, but go in there, be nice, say hey, buy your stuff, start up a brief conversation. Before you know it, they're not going to dread seeing you come in. And if they don't dread seeing you come in, they're going to pay attention to what you buy. And if they pay attention to what you buy and they like you, they might ask you for their phone number, and they might keep your games on a list behind the counter so that when they come in, you'll get a phone call.
Oh, thank you. Ian didn't dread when I came in. And then eventually you start a podcast with them. So there you go. It can happen. It's possible. Why did you groan? It happens. It can happen to you and your favorite game store employee.
But I mean, I can't. It's true. But what I'm also saying is, like, that's a thing that I did a lot in general with good customers. And that's what all of our employees did. If you like the customer, you know, we'll, if you're nice enough, and obviously we want to make money off of you, but we'll see stuff that comes in, even if you're not asking about it. And hey, we might shoot you a text. We might let you know on social media. Come on down. This is here. I can hold it for 24 hours if you want it.
You might text me on my still flip phone that I had.
Yeah, I took a picture with a flip phone of the
NWC card. And I'm like,
I literally just sent you a picture of the switches.
And I was looking at it, I couldn't tell what it was. I had to remember, I was like, what am I seeing? A shelf?
Yeah, you thought it was shelving.
And you're like, no, that's a dip switches. And I was just like, what the? It was a surreal moment back in, what was that, like March of 2009 or so, whenever that was, early 2009. It was nuts.
A while ago.
Well, I'm going to add one point here. God, I'm forgetting everything today on this podcast. I forgot my other point from the intro I was going to make. I had another counterpoint that I forgot about. I was going to add a little sub note that I totally forgot about. So those are our six things you should know before you start collecting retro games. Budget correctly. Patience. You can emulate before you buy or consider imports. Sellers are not always experts. Buy in lots and make some friends. We're all here to have fun, share an insane hobby with each other, share some knowledge. And yeah, that's the key to life, right, Ian?
Have fun. Enjoy yourself.
I can't believe I forgot what I was going to say for the last point. I had like a nice salient,
point.
I just remembered. Collecting video games takes up space. Make sure you have enough space.
It's half the reason I got out of it.
This is very important. Know how much space you need. Closet space. Display case. Do you have an extra room or not? If you're one of those people that have a basement that I'm envious of, you can have a basement area for a gaming sort of room down there. Make sure you have enough space. It wasn't the reason I moved out of my condo, but boy, it sure was nice to move out of my condo to have enough space. Now I have games crawling out of every closet and every corner. And, and out of my balcony. Remember, I had my balcony in tubs and things like that.
I do remember.
Now they're confined to like 1.5 rooms. So when you walk into my Castle Country, you don't think I'm a crazy person that has games laying around. Mostly.
Mostly.
That was the point I was going to make.
Mostly.
All right. Well, this was funny.
It was a good one.
Shorter than usual. We used to do like
I don't think this was not shorter.
1 hour, 25 minutes.
Really?
Shorter intro is the key to life.
Well, it was a shorter intro in general, but we hung on that last topic, so I thought maybe that had pushed us a little bit longer.
No. See, once we started, all our intros used to be 30 minutes, and then they started getting like an hour. Mm-hmm. That's like, God, we're not that important, and we can talk about everything. But no, nice. Budget size CU podcast super show. You got your money's worth still.
All right. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Take care. Get in early.
Bye.
Kickstarter ends Thursday night for the ultimate guide to the N64 library. Take care, everyone. Oh, I'll be streaming on Thursday.